So delighted to be joined on the line by Ian Hennessy, who did play in the first or the inaugural MLS season back in 1996. Also played as an Ireland youth international as well many years before that as well, and is currently the head coach of the University of Delaware and also a scout for US soccer. Ian, welcome along, first of all.
Thanks for having me, Ross.
No problem at all. Now, obviously, people might possibly gauge from your accent a bit of a Cork tinge, because that's where you originally come from. And maybe to start off, in terms of your own interest in soccer back home, how did that develop?
Well, primarily, first of all, I'm proud to be from Cork, of course, and best accent in the world. But the beginnings really were my father and friends, you know, your typical kind of terraced house kid back in the days in the 80s. And the 70s, just playing street soccer. But my father had made it as a pro and was trying to make it as a pro in England, but had played in all over the leagues in Ireland. And I guess that was really the beginning of my interest, my love affair with the game.
Yeah, and in terms of the development of your own career then in the early days, so you went over to Arsenal, so this was kind of the late 70s, early 80s?
That was, I would say, early 80s when I went to Arsenal. So I went to Arsenal, sent me home, wasn't good enough. I was playing with the Republic under 18s, and that would be 1984, when Cork City was founded, and played with Cork for the first 2 years.
Okay, and in terms of that experience, how did you find it? Because obviously it's a well-trodden path for Irish players to go over to England and to the big clubs, and obviously some make it, and then it can be difficult for others as well. Homesickness and other things can be an issue.
Absolutely. No, look, the first thing I'd say is that, you know, you have to kind of admit that you just wasn't good enough for that level at that time, right? So, like you said, there's a lot of players that went through, certainly Irish lads, to Arsenal and to other big clubs in England. That was our dream. But I do remember being, you know, maybe just overawed, really, with even the Highbury and Charlie Nicholas and Dave O'Leary, and maybe didn't have the, you know, the mental skill set really at that time as well, good enough to get over and good enough to play for Ireland and League of Ireland and whatnot. But for that level, to be honest, you need to have that extra, you know, 5-10% that separates you from the rest, which I didn't have.
And this would have been around the time, I think, Tony Adams is coming through, and Niall Quinn would join the club a little bit later on. So what do you think, what was it that kind of separated them from the crowd?
Well, Niall was wonderful to me, by the way. He was always a class act and kind of took me under his wing a little bit when he was over there. And Niall and I were on the same under-18 team under Liam Chewy and Brian Kerr. He was kind of finding his way at the time, I remember, kind of breaking through, trying to make the grade. If I'm honest, I thought Tony Adams at the time was a standout. He was clearly ahead, certainly of me and most of the team. He'd been in with the first team at 16 already, now was kind of peeking his head in there and back out again. But Tony was clearly just physically, mentally, great personality. He was easy to spot, right? He was your shouting talent. And then you had the likes of Niall, and below him was me. So, but they were, it was great, you know, Paul Martin, David Rolcastle, very talented kids going through. You know, if you get one or two of those pros to go through and make it, I think the clubs are happy. And they're, in Arsenal's case, they had three or four. So good for them.
Yeah, and of course you played League of Ireland football as well with Cork City. And again, when we talk about inaugural things with the MLS later on, this was their inaugural season as Cork City. Obviously, there were many iterations of the club previously, Cork Hibs and others. So this is 1984. In terms of lifestyle and standard of play back then in the League of Ireland, how did you find it, especially having been in England previous to that?
Yeah, it's funny because I would trade that experience right for the world, because the League of Ireland, particularly back in the day, for a young 17, 18-year-old playing against the likes of the Shamrock Rovers team of the 80s, was probably my favourite experience of them all, because you were in amongst the men. There was crowds there. It wasn't just young kids. There was a real buzz. Certainly in 1984, when Cork, like you said, it kind of been like the new resurrection of football in a great football city. But that was that's the one I loved the most, because it had more meaning. There was leagues to be won or lost. You know, there was relegations, there was FAI Cups, and you're playing against some big names of some quality clubs. But that was a great birth for me, birthing really a great kind of apprenticeship into the kind of big boy football, which I loved.
And at the same time, you're combining it. You're working for a taxi firm, aren't you, at the time?
I was, believe it or not. I was working for Mr. Henneberry, who owned the part owner of Cork City, had hired me. And it wasn't great days, Ralph. I don't know if you remember, but back in the 80s, Cork wasn't in the best of shape. Dunlop had closed, Forge had closed, so unemployment was high. So I was thrilled, actually, when I finished school to get a job. It was £1 an hour, believe it or not. I was getting to as the base operator to send the gypsy cabs into these locations to pick up passengers.
Yeah, and obviously then, you know, your way out is education and studying. So that brings you to America. How did that move come about?
So, interestingly enough, when I was in Arsenal, I had was offered a seat at UCC, which I declined because I wanted to make the grade as a pro. Then when I went back, it was too late to get that seat paid for Cork City. And a friend of mine who was also on the RSUT, and Pat O'Kelly, had been sent home from Liverpool and had made contact through Pat Devlin with a friend of ours who knew Eddie Kelly, who was the head coach of Seton Hall at the time. He's also another dog. And Pat had recommended me to Eddie, and Eddie happened to be in Ireland at the time and had picked up another player, Patrick Hughes, who was another dub that was actually playing with Cork City. So those two knew me and recommended me to Eddie to make the jump across.
Yeah, and at this point, when you move over to America, it's, you know, the North American Soccer League that everyone kind of remembers from the 70s, that's gone. And it's a bit of flux when it comes down to what's there. So how did you get involved in soccer, and did you have any ambition at that point, or at least did you see a pathway there to at least play even semi-pro or potentially even professionally?
Yeah, so we didn't really have a pro league. You're right, Ralph. The NFL had folded in, I think, the early 80s, and that was huge. And, you know, it was kind of a feast and famine. They were getting massive crowds, TV coverage, but it wasn't sustainable because you had the wealthy clubs and the poorer clubs, and not enough of those clubs were folded. So there wasn't really, there was a big void. There was regional kind of semi-pro leagues that had popped up. So I played and bounced around, you know, did the journeyman thing for a few years, until 1996, and that was the MLS was formed based on the back, really, of FIFA requiring big countries, now soccer countries, which America was becoming, to have a professional league. And if you remember, it was on the back of 1994 in the US, was a massively successful campaign here from a crowd perspective and revenue generator. So in 94 was the World Cup, and 96 was the MLS. So a lot of players like myself, who really at that time, honestly, Ralph, were past it, because I was 30, I was studying, I was a second year doctoral student at Columbia, New York, and I wasn't the ideal candidate, if we're honest here, but that was an opportunity. Yeah, I said, absolutely, I'd love to play for as long as I can.
Yeah, and you mentioned USA 94 there. Did you get over to any of Ireland's games? Because they were in the area you would have been around, so the at least, well, not the game that was down in Orlando, but the one in New York.
No, I wasn't, actually. I was teaching. I was running a teaching course at the time, but I remember being, and it was in New Jersey, of all places, where Giant Stadium was for that great victory over Italy, and there was an incredible buzz around for weeks afterwards, and probably still is, to be honest.
Yeah,
that was, you know, one of the famous days.
Yeah, and did you get a sense that Americans were getting a little bit excited about soccer? Obviously, they've had a World Cup staged and all the best players in the world in their country, and obviously it's not a sport that resonated much at the time, but was there maybe, did you see a few seeds of growth or green shoots?
Yeah, no, listen, go back to your NFL comments. So there really was a fair bit of interest maybe at the upper echelon, the guys, the expats who would go over, that really found maybe or formed the fan base, really, of the old NASL. But I will say, Ralph, by 94, there was a grassroots movement now, which maybe didn't exist as extensively as before. So there was not only an appetite, but also a little bit of knowledge as well, because this is you remember now, the late 80s and 90s, media, TV coverage, the internet's kicking in, so there's a lot of kind of forces that were had soccer out in front of people. So there was, one, certainly the grassroots effort; two, there was a little bit of knowledge; and three, the exposure. So it wasn't too much of a jump here It's easy to see in retrospect now that that soccer actually would take off in the MLS. Maybe could make it here, although at the start maybe nobody felt that because they were thinking about the NASL. But certainly the seeds were there for smart guys to see, business guys to see, and now it's been unbelievable now the last 25 years.
Yeah, and as you said, you were studying at the time and for a PhD, and this is at Columbia, and then Metro Stars come calling, and obviously they're, in terms of how that has changed, they're now known as New York Red Bulls, more or less.
That's right.
And when they signed you, in terms of your own decision making, I mean, how did that move come about? How did they contact you? And was it just a kind of an easy decision? This is a good opportunity. Let me see what or how it goes.
Yeah, ironically, a lot of the guys that made up the MLS in 96 were guys that had been bouncing around the semi-pro leagues for years. So we knew each other. So it wasn't too much of a leap of faith in terms of, you know, new faces and whatnot. We knew of them. We played with them. We played against them. The funny part, you know, for me was now you're playing a joint stadium, whereas the week before or the year before you're playing in like semi-decent but not great little parks, and here we are, same faces for the most part, playing in these big football stadiums because we really didn't have any soccer-specific stadiums. But the real odd part then was then you throw in the likes of Roberto Donadoni and Carlos Valderrama. And that was wild. It really was a surreal experience it's really hard to define it, to say the fact that you couldn't believe it, you're pinching yourself here. So in terms of the excitement, I was thrilled. I knew it was at the end. I was 30, 31 years of age. You know, I'm on my way in education with still my PhD. But this was an opportunity I couldn't pass up, so I was like a giddy child, really.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, Donadoni, of course, from the Great Milan team of a few years just before that, and then the USA internationals as well, Tony Meola, Tab Ramos. So, how did they all gel together? I suppose with your group of players, the kind of foreign star that comes in, and then the leading American players.
It was odd. I felt bad for them because they were stronger players. They're essentially full-time pros at this point. They're making bigger money. You know, some people would call us the Metro Donkeys, not the Metro Stars, and I think I was one of the donkeys there with guys like Donadoni, who at the time, Rath, had just come back from the European Championship in Italy. So for him, it must have been just as awkward. But he was a class act, and the American lads were doing the best they can here with this kind of group of these that had been bouncing around the place for years that weren't fully fledged pros here, even though it was a pro league. So I it was a little bit awkward, to be honest.
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing as well to see that Carlos Queiroz, who's managing internationally at the moment, but previous to that had already managed Portugal, Sporting Lisbon, and had coached at a high level, would go on to Manchester United and Real Madrid after that. And obviously, a fellow Cork man of yours, Roy Keane, wasn't his biggest fan at Man United towards the end. But
no,
we leave that.
That's true.
Yeah.
Listen, the funny story about him, just quickly, there was one time he got so mad at us, we're getting hammered in a game here, and he lost the ride with us, and he was throwing a couple of F-bombs, and he's like, you know, the problem with you guys is that you're all too educated. So their dressing room was full of guys who had degrees and law degrees and guys who were studying molecular biology at Columbia, and he couldn't get over the fact that, you know, back in Europe, you could be digging ditches or building houses or whatever. If you don't make the grade, and that we didn't have that hunger. But that was a funny story I remember from him at a halftime game.
And I think you've said it previously about that particular anecdote that you kind of saw where he was coming from in hindsight as well.
100%. No, look, this is at the high end of the game, which we weren't at the time. Now it's getting that way for sure. But this is his livelihood, right? More than ours, to be fair, at the time. So emotionally and psychologically, there's an investment that he makes at that level, which he has to make, that we didn't make it because we didn't have to. So no question about that.
Yeah. You did score a goal during that season as well. It's against Colorado Rapids. I've been kind of searching YouTube to see, can I find footage of the game? Doesn't seem to exist. But in terms of how well you remember it and how you can describe it, what was it like?
It was the greatest goal never to be recorded on camera, I'll tell you that. It was a piece of magic. It was Tab Ramos he beat. He was a World Cup star, probably the best player in the country at the time. And he beat like four guys, rolled it across the six-yard box, and he tapped it in, and that was it.
Well, great
I
goal.
wish I could say it was more. Yeah,
Yeah,
exactly.
hopefully somebody can dig it out at some point and we'll be able to frame it somewhere. I think at the time as well, in terms of 1996, you kind of described the front office as a bit like what we would maybe see as the modern startup. So it's a bit messy. And did you kind of feel optimistic that this league could survive with the mindset that was there at the time?
I was torn half, honestly. It went either way. It really was that shoestring. And you really, if you ever get a chance to talk to some of the business guys or the owners at the time, and there were very few of them, Lamar Hunt, that owned, I think, a couple of franchises, the Kraft, who owns New England Patriots now. And there was, it really was hanging on by a spider-thin kind of thread here. So we could have went either way. The business, I was losing money. I think some franchises did lose money over here. There wasn't a soccer-specific stadium, but they didn't have a great TV deal. So if you'd said to me at the time that it's going to go belly up in 2 minutes, I would have said, yeah, probably. But credit the guys, you know, the money guys, the business guys, those who had the vision to see what it became today, which is remarkable. You look at a franchise like Atlanta now, Raph, 3 years old, I think their valuation is $500 million with a B dollars, and I think the future is very bright over here.
Yeah, and it's looking good. Four more franchises as well coming along the tracks. But that season as well, just when I was looking through the manager, or the head coaches, obviously you had Queiroz, but Frank Stapleton, of course, that many Ireland supporters would remember as our longtime top scorer before Robbie Keane, and then previous to that, Niall Quinn had broken his record. But he was coaching New England Revolution, and obviously he had played for Arsenal back in the day. Did you cross paths with him in America while he was over there briefly?
No, I didn't actually. The only one I would cross paths with was the first Irish man to play. That was Paul Keegan, who was the guy that played at Boston College and he was actually the first Irish guy to set foot, I think, on an MLS. I was maybe the first Cork fan, but he was the first. But that was the only patch that we crossed over here with an Irishman in the league. There's more. Many have been since, but. That was, no, I didn't get a chance to. I think Frank had actually went home shortly after Raph as well.
Yeah, and I know you do a lot of scouting now, obviously. Well, you have done with US soccer. And in terms of the players you're scouting, are there particular examples that you kind of feel proud of a few years on, having seen how they've developed?
No, I'm a cog in the machine here. There is... certainly, the guys that come through, the Gio Reyes right now, the Pulisics, the ones that you go to watch and evaluate, and at their 13, 14 years of age here, there's obviously, you know, the personal pride here, but I'm happy to be, you know, as Michael Calvin's book read, you know, the nowhere men, if you will, that's behind the scenes, or just, you know, making notes and passing them on to the national staff. I take great pride in that. There's about 100, 150 scouts across the nation. And we have so much work to do over here, Raph. We're really just scratching the surface at the moment here. But the youth teams in particular do pretty well, I think. And if you look at international competitions, the under-17 and the World Cup, the U.S. does fairly well. And the under-20 certainly do fairly well. And I do think with the crop coming through here, you're going to see a better product with the men's, the full national team. But I still think we're probably 30 or 40 years away here from being a dominant force on the war stage.
Yeah, and one of the interesting threads when it comes to American soccer as well, just watching from afar, there's the whole pay-to-play element as well when it comes to young players coming through, which is a barrier, of course, and maybe doesn't exist in the same way when it comes to American football, as in the NFL-style game or the NBA. And that's probably, you know, those other sports are able to capture players who, I suppose, when it comes to sport, it is a thing of survival, maybe, in comparison. Do you see that changing in terms of that mindset, maybe, where they, you know, they remove that barrier for players coming through?
It will only change, Raph, if the business model at the top end changes. So once these athletes come through, and the MLS now has come out and declared itself to be a selling league, much like Ajax is a selling club, right? So they want to sell young players abroad, they want to make some money. Only when that end of the market, right, when the tip of the spear really starts to make money, well, I think you see more and more being reinvested at the youth level by the MLS teams. And it has to be driven by them and by the federation. But I don't think, as of yet here, even though there are a lot of Americans going to the Bundesliga, some going to England, they're not going for the valuations that really drive the kind of hero, the cult figure, the LeBron level, the Messi level, or maybe the more that, to be fair, that people can see soccer really as a pathway that has something at the a pot of gold in the rainbow, if that makes any sense. So I think as the valuation of the league goes up, as the franchises get more and more expensive as they have success in the CONCACAF championships, beating the Mexican teams, going on to the World Club championships. Once that happens, once you see players sold off, I think there's kind of a knock-on domino effect that will trickle down to more investment, to a more defined pathway at the much younger ages to get those kids that typically would go to other sports or that simply can't afford to play into our system.
Yeah, and as we touched on earlier, so the MLS has grown from the time you were there. There are now 30 teams by 2022, yeah. There will be anyway. And there are other leagues like the USL as well, which kind of fills some of the other cities in between. But in terms of that whole professionalism trickling down, because of course, America is a vast place, huge amount of cities and towns, yeah. And everything else. What's the next step in terms of, you know, filling those gaps? Because there are a lot of places, I'm sure, that are kind of off the grid in terms of representation at the highest level.
Yeah, they do. They have a great system over here, Raph. I don't know if you followed it, but what they do, and this happens a lot with these expansion teams for the MLS, is that they will go into a city and they will put out word that maybe, you know, we'd like to invest in this city. And what they do then is they let the grassroots and the local kind of soccer community embrace it or not embrace it. And then if they do embrace it, there'll be a backer, a businessman or two that will come in. And they give them then maybe a USL franchise and see how that develops. So what's happening really is that they plant all these seeds all over the country in these cities, and then they see which takes hold. And if the city takes hold, and they see that there's an interest, that there's a potential season ticket holders, that there's a potential stadium, that there's buying from the community. That's kind of the model that the MLS has grown in recent years, and it's worked quite well for them.
Yeah, and as they're developing, and as you say, there's a lot of interesting things happening there. I don't know how closely you follow what's happening over here in Ireland in terms of soccer. We're at a kind of tipping point, obviously, because there have been major change with the FAI. But if there was something Irish soccer could maybe pick up and learn from the US, because the US obviously started pretty recently in terms of the most recent development, what are the kind of things you'd kind of recommend?
I would say that, you know, the first thing, and I think Niall is a great ambassador for this, but you need a strategy, right, Raph? You need benchmarks, you need goals, you need backers. It has to be realistic, and then you have to manage that. So that's the one thing I think the American, not that they're better businessmen than anybody else, but they're very good with strategy and strategizing and setting goals and targets, and then, you know, they're walking their way back from that. And I'm seeing it happen in the League of Ireland. Like I listened to a very interesting podcast recently about Dundalk and their success and how they're looking at the Champions League money, and they're buying players to get them to that level, which is a massive kind of a pot of gold here, because the Champions League now is kind of this kind of hyper-capitalistic the end game for everybody to get there, to build a club, to buy the players, to make them better. So that kind of strategy and getting the business interest, not just the football interest, the soccer interest, but getting the business interest to have a really broad strategy. I think the US do, or the MLS certainly has done that very well, and I'm sure Ireland has taken note.
Yeah, and I suppose before I let you go, obviously you've managed to keep the accent, which is brilliant as well, I must say. But
yeah.
do you get back to Cork or even Ireland in general often enough these days? I know you're very settled, obviously, where you are, but do you get back on holidays from time to time?
Not enough, Raph. I don't. I have two young daughters, not young, but they're teenage daughters now, and the expense of it and getting back, and with the college season and scouting for US soccer, doing the local youth stuff, I really don't get back. I wish I could get back more often.
Yeah, certainly. But anyway, best of luck with the University of Delaware, and it was fascinating chatting to you about a period I think that maybe people don't remember as much, because not nearly 25 years from that inaugural MLS season, and so much has changed. But Ian Hennessy, thanks a million for taking the time.
Thanks, Raph. Bye-bye.